irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Tori, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the show. Today is Monday, May Day, right?
Mm-hmm.
May 1st. They call
it's
it May Day.
It's gonna be May. Have you heard that one? That's Justin Timberlake Day.
Oh, no. So I didn't. That's why I don't know it, because I don't know many of his songs.
Oh. He's saying a song, It's Gonna Be Me, but he has a very weird voice, and he sings it, It's Gonna Be Me.
Oh,
so
gonna
May
be
1st,
May.
Everyone says, it's Justin Timberlake Day.
Oh.
It's gonna be May.
Okay.
Yay.
My birthday's coming up.
Yes.
And in a few days, and that's all that I care about when May comes around. Mother's Day actually
Mother's
is
Day?
Coming up, right?
Yeah, when is that?
That's probably next, probably this Sunday, because
shut up, it is
it's
not.
Always after my birthday, or like at about
it's
the same time.
Maybe a couple weeks.
Oh, wait a minute, no, my birthday is in 10 days, so it's not this, it's next weekend.
Shoot, what do you get, Mom?
I don't know. What do you get, Mom?
I don't know.
Give her a phone call. She'll appreciate that.
Yeah, but
that
we talk three times a day because we're totally, totally a mess. It's terrible.
So how about you don't call
her? Yeah, I mean,
that'll be unusual.
She's like, Tori, what's happening?
Right. Wow,
yes.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So you guys talk a lot, huh?
We chat a lot. I talk a lot to my father, too.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
And then they're very, like, the cliche Jewish parents. When I get on the phone with one, it's like, Judy, get on the phone.
Uh-huh.
And then one's dropping the phone, and one's like, is it speaker? And I'm like, oh, my God. They're very, very, we're very close, yeah.
Well, that's very nice. I wish my kids were like that, too.
I know.
Maybe one day they'll call me just to say, how you doing, Dad?
Do they never do that?
No, it's just about, I need this, I need that.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Like, I want to have a funny retort, but I just feel terrible.
Yeah, right?
That's terrible.
Yeah, I know.
Well, you guys, listen
to the sound.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, we got, it got like a little lower, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Here, I'll try that. Let's see if that will work. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. I always notice these things.
When you go low, sure.
Look,
you go
it's
high.
Disappearing again.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
Yeah.
What's going on here? Wow.
Maybe it just isn't staying high.
Well, I don't know. Let's continue talking.
All right.
And if we disappear, we fade away.
Yeah,
what can you do, you know?
It's like Back to the Future.
Yeah, exactly.
In the picture when Michael J. Fox just disappears.
Exactly, you know? But, yeah, so things always happen in the morning. I don't know why that is, but, oh, okay, now I understand why. Okay. So Ronan adjusted that. Okay. So let me fix that.
All right.
Okay, let me bring up my microphone. I guess we were too loud. All right.
I've been told that before.
Thanks for that. Yeah, I didn't understand. I'm like sitting here and the sound is lowered, but he's doing it remotely because it doesn't sound very good. So there you go. Anyway, welcome to the show, everyone. We have a great guest waiting, and we're going to get to her in just a moment. And just a couple things, Tori. Ryan Seacrest, I guess, is joining live, right?
Yes.
With Kelly Ripa.
Yeah, he's the new co-host.
He's the new co-host.
Yes.
So do we care?
You know, here's the thing.
Yes.
I mean, I care because I like pop culture. And at one point, you could not be bigger than Ryan Seacrest.
Right?
I mean, there was a time when that man was everywhere.
Busy all the time, right?
And he produced, don't ever forget that he's the executive producer of the Kardashian show, Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
Oh, he is?
So this man is in everything.
Yeah.
So, and then for like a couple years, there's no Ryan Seacrest. I don't see Ryan Seacrest around.
Well, no, but he's got a radio show.
Yeah, he does, but you don't see the same way that he was.
Right.
This will bring you back to the good old Seacrest.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I think they look a lot alike in a lot of ways. They're very small, blonde, chirpy, happy people.
Right.
And I think he's fine. I wish they had done someone a little more authentic. I find him a little plastic.
Yeah, he is, right?
Yeah. In my head, I wish they could have picked me. But you know, that's
gonna
be
me. Well, first of all, you can't qualify because you don't have the equipment down there to be
a
co-host for Ripa.
But why not have a girl?
Okay, I don't have a problem with that.
Kathy Lee and Hoda? They're doing great.
Right, but the show has always been about one man, one woman. So
life moves on, Sam. We change.
Okay,
we change,
but they've got to go with the ratings.
I know. I mean,
and I'm sure the women want to see a pretty face, too.
Yeah,
you know?
I like that Strahan was, like, really different. I thought, like, Leguizamo was on for a long time, for a little bit. I liked when they had different hosts, so it's not all just, like, bright white teeth. I feel like there's a lot of bright white teeth on that show now.
Probably,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, not that I ever watched it, but I remember when Regis was there.
He's the best,
right? Oh. He was good, but that was a long time ago.
Yeah, but you can't deny Regis. Man. Yeah, he is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And apparently he and Kelly, I read a whole long thing about them. They don't talk. She's just shut him out.
Really?
Yeah. And so he's like, I'm not invited to the shows. I don't get when I'm there. She does hardly spend time
like
with
him.
Me. I mean, I don't know if it's not a like or if she wants to move on. Or, I'm not sure, but he feels very sort of shut out.
Yeah. Well, you know.
But you don't know if maybe he wasn't great to her in the. You don't know.
Right.
I hope they were like best friends and had picnics every day, but it like it doesn't turn out that way. I was so hoping they had like their kids all over and, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Because you know Kathy Lee and Regis were like very close.
Yeah.
And that's what made those two just phenomenal.
That's true, yeah.
They talk about their mornings and I would be dying.
Yeah. I know. Kathy Lee's still around though,
she
right?
She is. She's with Hoda and she's killing it.
Really?
Yeah, she's on.
She's with Hoda. What's
yeah.
Hoda?
Hoda. She's the a really good news anchor.
Oh, I didn't know
you
that.
You don't know Hoda Kotb?
No. Oh. I don't. What channel are they on? What
they're
network?
Like on like People or Entertainment Tonight or the big ones.
Oh, okay.
They're on every morning, just like
Gotcha. Okay.
I think they're like the Good Morning America. Hold on, I'll find out.
Oh,
Kathy Lee. Yeah, she's back to being the top of the top.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
Oh, the Today Show. They're the morning of the Today Show. Yeah.
Do you know that she used to be on Good Morning America once?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. She's got a career that, like, everyone makes fun of Kathy Lee because, yeah, she talks about her kid, Cody, a lot and was somewhat of an irritating, over-the-top character of herself.
He must be, like, in his 20s now, right?
Yeah, Cody better be good-looking because right. She talked a lot about him. But, you know, to be honest, I'm following in much of her career and in the ways that I want, and she sort of made that career possible.
Right.
She sort of created the host position.
Right.
So
did.
I'm following. I bow down because you yeah. can't go tramping on the people you look up to. You know what I mean?
That's true. Even though she can be irritating at
times. She is, but like, she can be irritating, but man, audiences stuck with her,
her
loyally
right?
for yeah. years. Her whole career. Now she's on the Today Show
yeah.
with Hoda.
Wow.
Yeah. And they drink wine. It's adorable.
Really?
You would like it.
Yeah.
No, you wouldn't.
I used to watch Good Morning America with Joan London.
Ugh, great
and,
hair.
And David Hartman was his name.
I don't know. Just like Joan.
You don't remember him,
I know
right?
Joan, yeah.
That was the 70s. I mean, yeah. But she was great. She still does commercials and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Right? She had cancer or
yeah,
something?
I think she does like, yeah, these like, yeah, come join me on a something.
Yeah, like caregiving for my parents.
I think that's
that
what
stuff.
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's Lisa Gibbons.
It is?
Yeah.
Because I just saw...
Lisa Gibbons is a whole thing with caring for your parents.
Oh, because I saw Joan London.
Oh, well, maybe. Hey, you know, both people can care for their parents.
No, true, you know? And I mean, they're in perfect position to be endorsers
yeah,
of this
exactly.
stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Also, okay, so Ryan Seacrest, by the way, they're building a radio studio for him at the live studio
yes, yeah.
so he can continue doing
so
his show.
So he does this. They also, they build it wherever he goes. He's at right. a radio station built at the other place for American Idol.
Oh, okay.
And he's on Kiss FM at like... 8
yeah.
like 2:30 in the morning he's got to be on, like it's crazy how early
yeah,
so
yeah.
they built it for him so he can just be really easy and
yeah
very I mean that cool, guy is also like a trailblazer in the hosting position.
Well yeah, he's a money making machine. That's
yeah.
why they're accommodating him,
but he's smart about it. Like think about right. that guy in American Idol, that other host who was like I don't think it's gonna make it
right,
and now
right.
I'm like ooh.
I know, what was his name, Brian something? No?
Yeah, sounds good. Sounds
yeah
like
no it wasn't Brian, it was somebody
see,
else.
See, that's the problem, you don't know his name.
No, we don't know.
No, you don't.
You never know the number
I
two.
I think it was Ryan and Ryan, wasn't it? Was
no,
that a thing? No,
no,
I'm making that up. Okay.
No.
I think I might be making that up. But it's so stupid because like Ryan Seacrest picks good projects.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like to EP the Keeping Up Kardashians in the very beginning, which was like a decade ago.
Right.
That takes some vision. I mean, I know that's all, it's not great vision, but it's pop culture vision.
Yeah. Brian Dunkelman was his name.
Dunkelman, sure.
Yeah. I knew it was Brian. Didn't they say Brian?
Yeah, you sure did. Brian. He went to, I think he did Blue's Clues or some.
Oh, really?
Or he came from Blue's. He went to some kids program afterwards.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is he the Blue's Clues guy?
I think he went and did a cartoon animation thing afterwards.
Okay.
Right. But yeah.
But I guess they're saying he's best known for the American Idol.
Yeah, which sucks because, you know.
Yeah.
But you don't know. He
that
didn't know.
That was 2002. I mean, my God, you know, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, and American Idol was the first of its kind coming from Britain, which has a lot of those shows.
Right.
And like for America to have it and be such a hit, He should have smelled money coming out the bumhole. I mean, there's so much money in that show.
Ryan Seacrest did, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. So you got to be smart when you think about your projects. Yeah, you know what I mean?
You really do, you know? Yeah. I mean, because it's going to live with you for the rest of your life, you know?
Yeah.
And some maybe... Well, I think they kicked him out, you know? I don't think he was...
Oh, no, no, he left.
He left?
Oh, yeah. I've watched the whole thing on this.
Oh, my God.
Oh, as a host, it was like this, like, don't do Brian, don't pull a Dunkelman. It was like... Because, you know, everyone's like, how could you...
Yeah, how can people be so stupid?
Yeah,
right?
Well, you don't really know. He's like, I didn't know if it was going to go anywhere. Like, they offered me this other thing. Like, you don't know. Some people have two pilots, and they pick the one that, like, doesn't go, and you could have been on Lost. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, before we get to our guest, I just wanted to bring this up because this is one of my fears of turbulence in the air.
Oh, God.
An Aeroflot plane, you know, went through like what they call an air hole or something. Yeah, air hole.
Like a wormhole? No, like an air hole.
An air
like
hole. A that's where, like a pocket
like a
where
pocket,
it drops,
sure.
Right? And this was pretty serious. So 27 people were injured. And I mean, there's pictures with blood and everything in the airplane.
No, is it one of the ones where they went whoosh down and you like lose your stomach?
Yeah, and you like and you probably hit the ceiling and stuff.
Yeah.
So the ones that didn't have seat belts,
or they're probably up and or in the. In the or the bathroom, or there was probably
right,
or flight attendants were walking with it. Oh my god!
Yeah, you know, and
that does always scare me because you always hear people being like, "It can't hurt you, don't worry." And you're like, "Well, now it does."
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and then one day a plane is going to actually drop from the sky.
No, don't say it. So that's absolutely physically impossible. But
it's
also,
not, but come on,
no, but like from the air pocket.
Yeah.
But here's the other thing: is that's one plane and like a gazillion that fly every moment.
Right.
So it's, you know, still the odds are against you, but it's, human brains tend to pick on that one.
Exactly.
You're like, but the 27 passengers.
Exactly. Like, what would I have done?
But there's like a bazillion that are fine.
Yeah, I know. But I guess when this happens fast, it just happens, you know. But when you're just going through continuous turbulence, you're like, oh, my God, would it stop already? It's like an earthquake, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not, it's a, if you're a nun and a Buddhist nun or a monk, you're great. Other than that, it's stressful.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But you're probably right. I mean, airplanes are designed to stay in the air.
Yeah, so turbulence can't ever actually hurt the plane, I've heard over and over again. Like, I've read a book on this.
Yeah, but what if it loses, like, its... You know, it's mojo or something. Yeah,
no, it can come back. It turbulence won't do it.
Right.
Other things can cause engine problems and stuff, but actual turbulence doesn't do anything physical to the plane.
Right.
Even though it feels very, very violent, it's not doing anything.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll keep that in mind next time I fly.
Yeah, there. Some Xanax, some vodka.
Yeah, there you
we'll
go.
We'll be fine.
All right. Well, we're going to bring in our guest now, who's sitting here very patiently.
Yay.
And we appreciate that. But I'm sure she's willing to, eager to talk. We're joined by Melissa Kent. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Melissa is in the film business, and in Hollywood we get a lot of these. Are you originally from L.A.?
No, not originally. I grew up on the East Coast.
Really?
And,
where?
Virginia, D.C.
That's where I'm from, D.C.
Yeah,
New Jersey. Yes.
My dad worked in the television industry, and his company moved us out here when I was 13.
Oh, wow. So what was he doing in the TV industry? Was he like...
He was a lawyer.
Oh, a lawyer. Okay.
It's a cool job for a lawyer.
That's a good thing to be.
If you are a lawyer, that's the coolest thing you could do.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So, well, that was cool. So, are you making it loud for her?
Yeah, she might go up a little.
Yeah. But hers is fine.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Is it okay for you better?
Yeah, okay, I was just having some problems hearing myself, although I can hear you guys amazing.
How is that possible? Okay, well, let me bring this up. Can you hear yourself now better?
Check.
Much better,
let's
right?
Let's carry on.
Okay,
there
you go. All right. So, what was it like growing up there? Did you have a big family?
No, I don't have a big family. It's just was the four of us, and I have a sister, and... We moved a lot growing up when my dad changed jobs and came out here New Year's Eve of ninth grade, which was a challenge.
Awkward.
Because in New Jersey, ninth grade is high school and here is junior high.
Wow.
So
really?
I kind of got to live the Mean Girls thing twice.
Wow. That's great. That's great for your self-esteem.
Like the oldest grade of junior high. And you know, it's never easy to move across the country. I never thought I had a New Jersey accent until I called my friend 6 months later. But just, you know, there was a lot of change. It was a different scene, very much so.
Yeah.
But I think it really prepared me for working in the film industry because I have at least two jobs a year, often more. And so just by having to go through a lot of changes.
You're used to it.
Yeah, between moving and then starting high school for the second time in 10th grade, and then my parents' divorce, and starting college, and just trying so many different things. I think it left me prepared for the constant upheaval of being a freelancer in Hollywood.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're also dealing with Mean Girls in Hollywood. I feel like it prepares you. Sometimes you, no, as an actress, like you can sometimes deal with Mean Girls. So right. It's a good preparation for LA.
There you have it.
There you go. It's a good starter course.
Right. But it's, I can imagine that age is very hard to change places. I mean, I know I did. We moved around several times when we lived in Israel.
I can't even imagine what it's like.
And you have to start all over again, right? The new friends, the new new everything, new culture. And, you know, ninth grade is kind of tough. You want to be accepted badly, right?
Ninth grade is tough.
I would agree, yeah.
She's like, yes.
There you go. So my memory serves me well. So you moved here. I mean, did you look forward to moving here? What was going on in your mind? I mean, that's like, it boggles my mind because some kids are like, they look forward to moving because it's something new, you know? But some are scared. How did you feel about it?
Well, gosh, it was a while ago now, but I do recall being excited that I thought I could reinvent myself. But then again, that's kind of sad thinking that I needed to. So of course it didn't really stick, and you are who you are, and you always eventually find your niche. I was thinking about it this morning because I went to Pali High, and it's a very big high school, and a lot of celebrity and Hollywood children go there, and some of whom have become, you know, very successful actors. And so growing up in New Jersey, I'd always wanted to be involved in theater and was looking forward to high school for that reason. And then having moved across the country right at that time, I was too shy to take part. So that's one thing I regretted, although ultimately I was a theater major at UCLA.
Good for you.
You've overcome
things.
There you go, you know. So you're with Palisades, right?
That's right.
That's a pretty nice area out here in L.A. So you had a pretty privileged childhood, wouldn't you say?
I mean, you know, yes. Like, not privileged, not upper class by any means. I mean, you know, but my dad was a professional. My mom was a catering manager over at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. And so, you know, friends of friends were always involved in Hollywood. And that proved very helpful, too, when I determined I wanted to become an editor. I'm here today, of course, to discuss the short film that I directed. But I've made my career as a feature film editor. Some of my credits include The Virgin Suicides, The Age of Adeline, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants,
too. Wow, and you did the entire films, right?
Yes, the editing, I was the picture editor, exactly.
Wow.
So when I was ready to graduate college, and I was... I had been an intern at Entertainment Tonight, speaking of Lisa Gibbons.
Oh, funny.
And that's where I was first exposed to what editors do. They were amazing, exposing the college interns to every aspect of production. And so we would go on interviews. We would go to studio lots and sit in on interviews.
I love good interns.
To see
like good internships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was in the research department there, but they let me sit in on set with the director. And when I sat with the editors, my eyes just opened. I always knew I wanted a skill I could do with my hands. And beyond having ideas, like, I really wanted to know a craft. And I saw how integral the editor is to storytelling. And simply by what comes before the next thing, what is next to what, conveys so much meaning and could really change the meaning, too. And they could build within their segments what they wanted to say.
Right.
And so I was fascinated by that, and back at school just learned everything I could about it and edited the student sitcom and the student soap opera.
Just anything.
Yeah.
Wow, how cool. I know, I really respect editors. I don't think they get enough credit.
Oh, 100%.
They're the ones telling the story, really.
I mean,
you know, you get all the little pieces of the puzzle, But you have to put them together, right? Yeah. So you're like next to the director. You're really the most important person.
Honestly, if anyone, if you've studied film, any little bit, I took like three courses at Michigan. Editors are the one you respect the most. Really, it's the thing you learn about the most. And any good director, like a Scorsese or Tarantino, will always respect their editors and always give credit. That's right, really what you do.
Because they implement what they've envisioned.
Correct. There's some. Right? It's just an unbelievably hard thing to do. I can't even imagine.
Well, it's very detail oriented. They call it the final rewrite.
Yeah.
And it is always a joy when you hear directors acknowledging their editors as their colleagues and co-creatives.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think by nature editors may be a little more introverted.
Yeah, I was just gonna say they're probably more introverted. That's right.
And it's you do spend a lot of time alone, although I had a record of like, I don't know, 17 or 18 execs once in my room, you know, looking over my shoulder.
That's no pressure at all.
Changes, yeah. So you have to be calm under pressure. And you have to be, you know, someone that the director wants to hang out with all day on top of it. And it's extremely detail-oriented in that editing is accurate to 1/24th of a second.
Wow.
And so you're making decisions, not just should we be in a wide shot or a close up or, you know, a shot of the food on the floor, but how long is that shot going to be held? And you just feel it in your gut, like this is the right amount. And 1/24th of a second later is too much.
Yeah.
So
in comedy, it's so similar. When I do stand up, if I'm literally a beat late or a beat early, I've ruined the whole joke. And my jokes take like 2 to 3 minutes.
Yeah.
So that's like half my set.
That's true. You've so gotta be,
and
rhythm,
you'll feel
right?
it when it's when you feel it. It's the right beat. It's like hitting a baseball. Right. It's like the sweet spot.
Yeah.
It is. If I ever write a memoir, the first sentence will be, I get bored in 1/24th of a second.
Yeah, that's so good, dude. Would you ever write a memoir?
I don't know. I've only have a sentence so far.
No, but that sentence is so
exactly.
good.
Exactly. You got a first
You edited
first
it
step.
Down. She edited it to a perfect sentence.
It's like a Vine memoir.
Yeah, it's like just over and over again.
Wow.
It's a great line. Yeah.
So, and we'll talk a little bit how you became a director and everything with your latest film, but let's talk a little more about the editing and stuff because I'm really fascinated with it, you know.
Sure.
So tell me, how long have you been doing this now? How long have you been editing?
Well, about 20 years.
Wow. Yeah. So you've been doing this for a long time. So you're like, okay, so you've been doing this for a while and then you decided, okay, I need to try directing.
How did that change?
Because you work with directors all the time. You work with film and stuff like that. You're wondering what it's like to be on the other side, right?
At first I wasn't. You know, people would ask me for the first several years of my career if I thought about directing. Because sometimes, too, they would notice the way I would work with the actors doing ADR, which is automated dialogue replacement. Sometimes the actors have to come back and say some lines again because if they weren't recorded clearly or the accent wasn't quite right or we're changing the line, for example. And I would get that asked that question and I would say, no. You know, I didn't feel up to competing with all the other directors who are so fantastic in this town. And I found my niche at the time. Here's what happened. So I was, one thing, I was very lucky early in my career to work a lot with Francis Ford Coppola, and I learned so much from him.
Respect!
Heck yeah. So one of my early credits was as co-editor on John Grisham's The Rainmaker, which I think was Matt Damon's first movie.
I was going to say Damon! I love that movie. As a lawyer, making all that money. Yes.
Was that his first movie, really?
Before Good Will Hunting? Oh, yeah. And no one knew who this guy was. Yeah.
I remember, you know, wishing Matt Damon would be famous by November when the movie comes out. And then he was on the cover of Vanity Fair. And yes.
Things are working out.
Things are working out. So after I finished working on the picture itself, his wife, Eleanor Coppola, had shot 85 hours of Francis working behind the scenes with the actors.
Wow.
And she wanted me to help her turn it into a 30-minute documentary for HBO. So what a gift it was for me to watch 85 hours
of
Francis working with the likes of John Voight and Danny DeVito.
You had a masterclass.
And Claire Danes, who was like 16 at the time.
Wow.
Virginia Madsen. Such a great cast in that movie. And we turned 85 hours into half an hour. And it is available on the DVD extras for that movie. But that was such a class in directing and in filmmaking.
That's a master class. You don't get better than that.
Yeah. And in fact, and I'll a few years ago when I decided really it's time to put pedal to the metal and give this a shot, just give it a try because I was so curious. And I started taking classes with Judith Weston, who's a well-known acting and directing coach. And she's written a couple books. One's called Acting for Directors, I believe. And her second book, I was trying to get it read before the class started. And anyway, I had just a few pages left. And sure enough, she mentions that very documentary that I edited.
No way.
Called Francis Coppola Directs the Rainmaker as a good tool for learning, you know, for watching directors work with actors.
Very cool, you know. So you got your feet wet early on and you got a feel for this and the bug to actually do this, right? So you decided at what point, okay, so you decided I'm going to try and direct now, right? So did you have already a project or did you decide I'm going to direct and let me look for a project?
Let me be honest. It sort of was in the back of my mind for maybe 10 years before I took action.
Some people are slower than others.
Yeah. And it's funny because I don't feel that I'm that patient of a person, but... what happened, I remember watching something like season 4 or 5 of Sex and the City.
Oh, nice.
And noticing that the editors had directed a couple episodes, one of them being a woman, Wendy Stansler. And I just thought to myself, well, if she can do it, you know, maybe I could do it. Maybe that's a path.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always thought, oh, you know, I'll work on a series for a while. And then maybe after a few seasons, I'll get a shot. And then the years go by and I finally notice that I don't work in TV. And I've just been working on one movie after the other. And, you know, sometimes in your life, you just get to a point where you say, if not now, when? Mm-hmm. I need to try.
Right.
I need to try. I'm just curious about being on the front side of production and being involved in decisions from casting to costumes to locations rather than reacting to what was shot.
Yeah.
Yes.
Creating instead of reacting.
And you had worked with many directors over the years, so you learned a lot, right?
I learned from every one of them.
Wow.
And I worked with Kenny Leon on a TV movie of A Raisin in the Sun, which he had also directed on Broadway.
I was going to say, that's such a play direct. Like, you see such a play. Even when you do it for TV, it's a play, it feels like. It's beautiful.
Yes. He just actually, he won the Tony for reviving that play a few years after I worked with him. And he would teach me about how you need to sometimes speak to each actor in a different way. You need to be sensitive to the way they receive information. And tailor your message that way. One thing Francis Coppola said that was really beautiful was that actors, you know, they don't have an instrument to hide behind, like if you're a piano player or a saxophone player or, you know, a billboard painter for that matter. They are their instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would say, when the light is getting dim, we'll all take 10 minutes and fix the light.
Mm-hmm.
But when the actor, you know, needs a moment, people don't have the patience.
Yeah.
So I always try to incorporate, you know,
the things that you learn. Yeah,
of course.
Wow.
And as an actor, like who studied I was theatrically trained, not in TV or anything, but in theater. And a difference in a director being sensitive to the way I work, it was vastly different if it was someone that just sort of blindsided everyone at the same way, sort of painted everyone with the same brush. So it's very important that each actor gets their own sort of, you know, you're thoughtful about each different actor and how they work.
Yeah, try to be. And he also called directing being a decision-making machine.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I thought, okay, I make good decisions.
Make good decisions.
So the time finally came to take some action. And I mentioned Judith Weston's classes, started reading a lot. But when it came time to find the particular film to make, and I figured, you know, it probably was a good idea to start with a short film.
Yeah, I was going to say start short.
And one reason I had hesitated for so many years is if you look at the credits on a short film, they're nearly as many as on a feature film.
Mm. Wow. I know, and I was looking at your website and stuff. There are a lot of people, right? So, I mean, even for a short film, you need a crew, right?
Well, absolutely. You need a full crew. It's everything is equivalent. It's just fewer shooting days and fewer minutes of running time. But you still need a sound designer and a mixer and a composer and a color timer.
So why not do a feature?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, if I had the great script,
right?
Sure, and the funds.
Yeah.
So it took a year and a half to find the script.
Wow.
So you were looking around for a good script and everything, and so how did you find out this one? Now, by the way, for those of you just joining us, we're talking to Melissa Kent. She's the director of the film Bernie and Rebecca, selected for Oscar qualifying festival. So Cleveland International,
which is very well known.
Really?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh wow, that's awesome.
So it just completed.
So how did you? We'll talk about that. Sure. But what I just wanted to introduce the movie. But how did you find the script for this movie?
Well, what I did was I contacted various screenwriting competitions and asked to read their finalists. And
that's so smart.
What a great idea.
That's so smart.
Thank you. So
making good decisions already.
Now, like I said, it took a year and a half before I found this particular script, but I had contacted the Canadian Short Screenplay Competition. And once we started talking, they asked me to be a judge. So through that, I did read quite a few scripts, but this one didn't cross my way. And so then after I finished Age of Adeline, I was having coffee with the guy who runs it, and he said, you know, there's a script you haven't read, and it was a finalist, and it's called Bernie and Rebecca, and I think you would like it.
Ooh.
And because I knew on a practical level, I knew I wanted two people having a really interesting conversation in a space. You know, I wanted something producible a la, you know, Reservoir Dogs that we all aspire to, but had to be really interesting. And so just...
But it's containable. It's that, like that you can contain it. Yeah.
And so Bernie and Rebecca is a comedy about a couple after a blind date imagining a future together. But it's not the perfect future with the big house and the white picket fence and angelic children. No. So, and the question it explores really is, if you could know how your big decisions in life would turn out, who to marry, whether to have children, what kind of job to do, and that not only would it lead to joy and happiness and fulfillment, but also heartbreak, betrayal, would you do it anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And in 14 minutes, you know, these actors go through a lifetime of emotion. So once I read it, I couldn't get it out of my mind.
Wow.
And it was written, though, even as though it could also be a one-act play. It's written by John Harris. Now, this is very unusual. John Harris used to be CFO of the Carlyle Group, which is a big hedge fund in D.C., and he had retired before the crash because he wanted to pursue writing.
Wow.
Very cool.
And so he wrote this, and it was a very different perspective on life than, you know, I've lived myself. But, you know, the character was a young woman. I really identified with her yearning to know the future. Like, I've had friends say, you know, on the first date, like, say, oh, well, did you ask him if he would convert to Judaism? And I'm like,
slow down.
First day, like, slow down. I don't know. I would never do that.
Yeah,
but I know people do.
Wow.
Yeah. So, once
because it's a deal breaker for them, right? I mean, so that's the first thing they
had. For the friend, it was, yeah.
Yeah.
But I always wonder, like, if you could, like, this is a good Black Mirror that we were talking about. We were watching Black Mirror, which is a Netflix, started the BBC, but it's shows about technology and future and, like, questions. Like, you know, Twilight Zone, like, provoking philosophical questions. And it's like, if you could know the future, would you want to know it?
Right.
And I don't think I would.
No, I don't think we should, and that's why I think we were created
some people,
this way.
Right,
you know?
Some people want to know.
I know.
They want to know. Would you want to know?
I know that I don't want to know, which is why on 23andMe, when things are locked, that could be devastating genetic information, I don't unlock it, but for example, my mom does.
Interesting, because I know people that would.
Yeah.
She 23andMe is the DNA testing, yeah. Right?
Right.
Exactly, and hi, Mom. She also reads the last page of the book first.
Oh, God.
And,
there are people like that.
Well,
they need
I
to
never
know
thought
the,
of that.
Oh, yeah,
before.
They need
maybe
to know the ending.
Could, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
I should do
something. I think people do want, some people want to know and have it rigid, but it feels like right. It would give you no free will.
Exactly,
yeah.
And that's the point I was trying to make. If we know the future, there's no free will anymore, because we're just going to know what's going to happen, you know, so you just don't do anything about it. The reason people want to know, I think, also is the anxiety they get from uncertainty
yes.
about what's going to happen, and they're afraid.
Yes.
So it always comes down to fear, I think, you
yes.
know, and if you're not fearful, you're going to take on anything that life throws at
you. And like the book I'm reading is Getting Comfortable with Uncertainty. It's not easy, nor probably doable in my lifetime, but I'm trying.
It's by Pema Chodron.
It's my Buddhist teacher, and it's like the word uncertainty even makes people uncomfortable.
Right.
Like getting comfortable, that whole concept will end suffering.
Right.
I don't know how to do that, but I'm trying.
That's why I think we should accept the fact that we're not supposed to know the future, and that makes our lives more interesting.
Mm.
So anyway, so this is very interesting. So you decided to address that point, and so John Harris is the writer.
Yes.
So you connected with him after you found out about the... Now, did you read about the script before you met him?
Yes, I didn't meet him in person until after the movie was shot.
No way!
Well, he lives in Virginia.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So we had a phone conversation, and you know, I wanted to produce this, direct, and really be the person making the decisions creatively. But of course, first I had to get the rights to the story, which I learned from Film Independent. You know, it's no use even speaking to any other collaborators until you own the rights.
Really?
And I called John, and we had this hour-long conversation all about creative storytelling. He's just the nicest guy you could ever hope to meet, and real Southern gentleman. And he gave me the rights.
Yeah.
So then I was off to the races.
Had he been writing for a long time before that?
He had written and another short film called Playing Through, and it was directed by an Oscar-winning director, and so, you know, it was a little intimidating.
Yeah, right. That's a great second time, right? No pressure again.
Yeah, exactly. But he couldn't have been lovelier. I got to work just with the step-by-steps of making the film.
Right. Now, didn't this seem to you insurmountable at a certain point, or did you always feel, I can do it?
I always just felt like, okay, I know what the next step is. And you take enough of those steps and you will
get to the end.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you were confident because you knew what you were doing, right? I mean, I wouldn't even know how to start. But there, I mean, how would you even find all this great team that you have?
I mean, you've been working with great people.
Producer and director of photography and composer and sound designer, like you said, casting, everything. How do you connect with all these people?
My very first step was to find a producer to work with me. And so I spoke to someone in my directing class who produces a lot of commercials, and she introduced me to Mary Pat Bentel, who's done a lot of independent films. She's had a lot of success with films that have been to South by Southwest and Sundance. And we met, really hit it off, and wanted to work together. So then once you have that colleague, she knows so many people, so she introduced me to director of photography Nicole Whitaker. I looked at a lot of reels of DPs, and what really stood out to me was Nicole's framing. Even when she's doing a documentary, there's always an interesting foreground element, and yet she does commercials. She knows how to make people look beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want the stereotypical indie,
rough, dirty, edgy,
and especially because the main character Rebecca is a model, there has to be, and Bernie is, he thinks what he wants is beauty in his life, right, and beautiful children, that there had to be an element of beauty
and like polished.
You always have to have that. I mean, you want people to fall in love with the cat.
But if you do an indie, it's all like, huh? Especially in the 90s, it was all like grunge. They call it cowboy style, where you're just like, and the camera kind of shaky. But like, there's a different way of doing like a polished look for camera.
Well, and there are moments where it has that handheld or steady look. But I wanted to be really particular about those, that those would serve the storytelling and not just be an overall aesthetic.
Right, and the story is more about conversation and dialogue than everything else, right? I mean, there's no, like, in a short film you don't do like special effects and all this type of stuff. You focus more on the character, right?
In this case, yes. So these two people were having a very interesting conversation about a potential future together, but I still wanted to make it more cinematic. So although it was written as two people talking in a room, I chose to incorporate flash forwards. So when they're talking about children, we're seeing the children. When they're talking about...
So it's like their dreams. You're visualizing their dreams.
It's their imagination. Well, the thing is, it's their imagination, but there's a particular twist at the end which throws everything into question. So I've had some people say, well, wait a minute. some people say, hey, it proves that they got together because we saw all these flashes and therefore, and then other people say, well, wait a minute, maybe it's already happened and it's a memory, the night in the apartment.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So there you go.
It's
wow.
like La La Land when she has that scene where it's like, in the end, they go back and they change one thing in the previous scenes, like in the very beginning, and they do a flash forward of everything that could have been different.
Oh, wow.
It's like, oh.
So, I like mechanics like that for a story. You change things around. You
play with
you
future
surprise
time.
People. Yeah, you know? And that's a nice thing. Do you remember the movie, was it... I'll think of it in a minute, but everything was going backwards. Do you remember?
Memento. Yeah.
Edited by Dodie Dorn, who was nominated for the Oscar for that.
That's right. And it was such an editor-heavy movie. I mean, you really had to be... That was the director, but it was the editor.
Yeah, because you had to understand what you're doing.
Yeah, Guy Pearce. Wow. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
I remember my mom being like, I'm just really confused. And I was no way, where you're
exactly.
supposed to
be. That means the movie is good.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, I think... Was it the color scenes that went backwards in time and the black and white scenes went
forward in time?
Right.
Which is kind of opposite what you're used to, too. You know, it's like usually you see sepia and black and white going backwards. I mean, everything was great. I remember he's like, wait, am I chasing this guy? No, I'm being chased.
Right.
He has no memory.
I know. It's very cool, you know, the way it was done. So, surprises, twists, playing with the time and the sequence is awesome also. Pulp Fiction was also, they played with the sequence, right? Of when everything happened. They like started in the middle, went to the beginning and then to the end.
Yeah, he plays
right?
with time a lot and sort of warps time. But it's always been a great feature to use in film, but he does it really well.
I know, very cool. So Melissa Kent, the movie is Bernie and Rebecca. How can people see it?
It's online right now, which is very exciting. They can either go to BernieAndRebecca.com and right there on the homepage, just click and watch it, or go to YouTube and search Bernie and Rebecca.
Sounds good. So you don't have to look for it all over the place. I mean, some people like have to find like those independent movie theaters and stuff to see it. But now there's different ways to distribute, right?
Well, that's what's so exciting about this week, because we've been keeping it offline for the last year while we were in festivals.
Right.
So it appeared in 36 festivals.
Oh, my God!
From Hawaii to Edinburgh to Berlin to Milan.
And you went to all these places.
I didn't go to everyone.
Oh.
That's a lot of travel.
That is.
As it is, I spent quite a bit more probably on the travel than on the movie. But no, we're very fortunate to also play in New York and Virginia Film Festival, the Los Angeles Shorts Fest, and finishing up at the Cleveland International Film Festival, which, as you mentioned, was one of the Oscar qualifying festivals that we got into.
Cool. Then did you edit your movie too?
I did, and it was a little lonely because
no one's there.
I know, and so
no director,
there's no person to bounce off of unless you're talking to yourself.
Right. Which is harder than you would think. And is this funny? I like it.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's no one there. Yeah.
So.
Well, so it's hard, even though it's you, it's your project, but you still, you're saying it's better to have other people's opinions too, another set of eyes maybe?
Well, I certainly put on my editor's hat because for me, directing is all about accumulating options, and you have a bunch of different camera angles, various takes, and in this case, you know, do I use the flash forwards? Do I not? How do I use them and when? But then once you have a nice assembly, I started showing it to people right away.
Mm-hmm. Some people, writers need to have it heard, or you need to see it, have it seen by other people to see what they think.
And also, to your point about rhythm, the spoken rhythm is so different than what's on the page, and then the edited rhythm, different yet again.
Right.
And so...
it's like music.
Yeah. No, and that's what I was saying. That's why the word rhythm came to me, because that's what you guys were describing, you know? It's like you have to have a certain pace at which you go and to create the tension, to keep the interest there. And there's a lot of things you need to think about.
There are a lot of details.
There are way too many details. That's amazing.
But you see, but maybe people will appreciate editors more because they don't get as much credit as they deserve, I think.
Well, thank you for saying that.
That's true.
No, but it's true. You know, I mean, how many people know who edited a certain film? You know, we know who directed. Sometimes we know who produced. We know who acted in it. But we don't know the people behind the scenes, you know? So,
and it's funny because a lot of them are more introverts, like you're saying. So they're not like in public often, like splashy as much. You know,
I think the challenge too is that we are not creating a physical thing. So the costume designer, you can look at a dress and put it on display in the lobby of the Landmark Theater.
Right.
But the editing is reductive. So mm-hmm. it's like, well, I had a million feet of film, or you know, I had 200 hours and I turned it into an hour and a half. And right. so these are the pieces we're showing you that tell the story at, you know, at its best, that in our right. opinion. But it could have gone a million other ways. Wow. And that's a very personal thing. Every editor would mm-hmm. edit something differently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking of this like a memory game, you know? It's like, because you have to remember all the different pieces you have, yeah. right?
Absolutely.
Wow.
I bet editors are good with puzzles. I bet they
you
are.
You have to be. I mean, you're yeah. picking up all the different pieces and you yeah. put them together, you know? I mean, I don't know that I'd be able to remember that much, you know, to be able to be that organized.
Well, the other thing is, if you guys don't know, editing booths, they're called, are like pretty dark, small rooms, right?
Oh, not necessarily.
Oh, they can be nice. I was in really cheap ones, I think. But they're like intimate, like you have to be okay, like very, in a like a closed space with someone for a long time.
Yes, they're not, I mean, sometimes you get lucky and you have a really large room. I always like to have a window as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you should have nothing wrong with natural light.
That's
we're
true.
Just at computers like everybody else.
That's true, right? Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why I never was, there was no windows in the editing booth.
No, but you're right. I've been to many editing booths.
And they're dark.
And like that, yeah, yeah, yeah. But maybe because they want to get the feel of the movie when you watch it in the dark or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I see what you're saying. You see, I mean, I like daylight, any daylight all the time. So I totally see what you're doing, yeah. you know. And that's cool. I mean, look. You're working. The bottom line is you got to be happy with what you're doing. If you need daylight, have daylight in there.
Yeah.
Some people like
that. I thought it would like ruin the film, and I realized, no, you're right. It's just computers.
Yeah. we'll cover the windows when we have a screening, or we'll go to a screening.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But just, you know, as a day-to-day thing.
I don't realize why. I didn't realize that. It's so dumb. I'm like, but the film. I'm like, it's digital.
You're not okay. exposing the film yeah. to light. So no worries.
Okay. Exactly.
Wow. So what's next for you?
Well, I just finished editing a thriller called Traffic. That's Ooh. Traffic with a K, starring Ooh. Paula Patton and Omar Epps.
Nice.
And written and directed by Deon Taylor. So I'm not sure exactly when that's coming out.
Nice.
But
she's so beautiful. Oh. He's so beautiful, but she's so beautiful.
Exactly. Wow. Laz Alonso and Rosalind Sanchez are also Ooh. Starring. And so I'm not sure when that's coming out, but we just finished it a couple weeks ago.
That's awesome.
Congratulations.
And it was fun to work awesome. In that genre. Yeah. Thank you very
Where
much.
Where was that shot? Here?
That was shot up north, Northern California, kind of outside of Tahoe.
Oh. How do you, what's the difference in a thriller rhythm? It's got to be so different.
Hmm.
Was it stylized or was it more natural?
Well, it was shot by Dante Spinotti, who is an Oscar-winning cinematographer. He did L.A. Confidential.
Ugh.
So it looks absolutely stunning. And it's interesting. Rhythmically, you're always reacting to the scene itself. Does it have one person or 50? Is it day or night? Are they on the run, or is she, you know, quietly thinking about her past? Mm. So you want to create a variety of rhythm, and also every cut is for story or humor. And so the question is always, what does the audience need to see next, or what do we want them to see next?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but this one does get very intense and very exciting.
I can't wait. In improv, when you call a scene, it's just, you go scene, and that's like, or blackout, but you call scene, it's the end of it, and you can use it, the cuts, to be funny. You're right. Like, you can use it as a humor. If it's something hits really well, you're like, scene, and then it's funnier, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So cuts can be used for humor, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very cool.
And as for directing, you know, it's a question. Going through this process and really exploring, you know, how do feature directors get jobs, or how do TV directors get jobs? I mean, it's an uphill battle. It's hard, I think, for anyone, especially someone with, you know, one credit on one short film.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, everyone has to start somewhere.
Right.
You know, for example, television, I read a statistic last year, the people who are given that first shot of directing, 5% of those people are editors, and 4% of them are white men.
Yeah, I was going to say
1% of them are either a minority or a woman.
I was going to say, as a woman, it's got to be even lower. Yeah,
1 in 200 chance. You know, so the idea of like sticking with a TV show for 3 years in order to get that chance, I was like, oh, that's probably not likely. So, definitely, you know, I'm on the lookout for a script.
Would you like to do TV?
Sure, I would. You know, you never say never, but everything's a choice, right? So it's like, for example, editing Traffic. It was so much fun and so exciting and so challenging sometimes to figure out exactly the way to tell the story, and I came home so invigorated. So then to basically start another career, even though there are many things similar. You know, you just have to sort of decide how to use your time.
Yeah, which fork in which road.
There you have it.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I don't know. Uncertainty.
Uncertain. Get comfortable with uncertainty.
Yeah.
A lot of fascinating stuff, folks. If you want to learn about film in Hollywood, this is where you tune in. Melissa Kent, director of Bernie and Rebecca, editor of many movies. So are you going to nominate this? I mean, are you put it? Okay, let's try it again. Are you going to go for an Oscar with this?
No. It's online for anyone and everyone to watch. Okay. And, you know, I really hope they enjoy it. It's funny. It's about love. And I also want to give a shout out to the beautiful music, which really elevated the tone, done by David Carbonara. Mm. He was the composer. He's a friend of mine. He was the composer on Mad Men for every single episode.
Wow.
And
wow, you work with the best of the best.
It was such a joy working with him and watching how his music could accent the moments, make the funny ones funnier, make the sad ones sadder. And I learned a lot from him, really enjoyed working with him. And also to Christopher Aud, who is a sound designer I've worked with on 5 feature films.
Wow.
He's a genius. He's worked on, you know, everything from like Mad Max Fury Road to Neighbors. He's just been doing this a long time, and we've done 5 movies together. And his sound just really made it sound like a Hollywood movie.
Wow. Yeah, there's a polish to it again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you were blessed to really meet and, like Tori said, work with a lot of great people. And congratulations to you on that. You know, you obviously have a lot to offer, and people realize that. You know, I did see the trailer. Go right now and check it out. It's at BernieandRebecca.com, and there's actually the trailer. And the film itself, I watched the trailer while Melissa was here, and I thought it was like, I just went like, what? At the end, you know? So you're giving...
I love a twist ending.
Yeah, and you get the clue for the twist in the trailer. So
that's
there
good.
You go.
That's
you
good.
Can't ask for more than that, right?
And thank you to my assistant editor, Susan Kim, for editing the trailer so beautifully.
There you go.
That's awesome. I used to work for a company that made trailers. They made the one for Passion of the Christ. I don't know if you know them, but I think they're still around. But I remember watching the process, and I just went, wow.
So intense, so you tedious.
Know, wow,
yeah.
Well, Melissa, thank you again for joining us. Much success to you. Come back, tell us how everything else is turning out. Traffic sounds amazing to me. Why is it with the K? Is it like Russian something, communist?
You don't know.
We don't know. Okay.
Well, we're distinguishing it from the other.
Other traffic. I was going to say, there is an Oscar. Yeah, yeah, there is another traffic.
Yeah.
That's true. All right. Well, thanks, Melissa. All the best.
Tori,
thank you, Sam. Thank you.
Anytime.
Thanks, everybody, to our listeners, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Tori, only on LA Talk Radio.